Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Myler. I'm an addict. Just again, like to welcome you to the Triangle Obsession workshop. And we're going to start this. Charlie's going to come up and read the whole pamphlet. I've dispersed some pamphlets on your desk. We don't have enough for everybody, but I do have a little stack left here. If you're interested, just hop on up and grab one. And without further ado, Charlie's going to read it out.
Hi, everybody. I'm an addict. My name's Charlie. The triangle of self-obsession. When we are born, we are conscious only of ourselves. Am I loud enough, everybody? Okay. When we are born, we are conscious only of ourselves. We are the universe. We perceive little other than our basic needs. And if these needs are met, we are content. Our consciousness, as our consciousness expands, we become aware of the world outside of ourselves. We discover that there are people, places, and things around us, and that they fulfill our needs. At this point, we also begin to recognize differences and develop preferences. We learn to want and choose. We are the center of a growing universe and expect to be provided with the things we need and want. Our source of contentment shifts from basic needs miraculously met to the fulfillment of our desires. Most children, through experiences over a period of time, come to realize that the outside world cannot provide all their wants and needs. They begin to supplement what is given to them with their own efforts. As their dependency on people, places, and things decreases, they begin to look at themselves more and more. They become more self-sufficient and learn that happiness and contentment come from within. Most continue to mature. They recognize and accept their strengths, weaknesses, and limitations. At some point, they usually seek the help of a power greater than themselves to provide the things they cannot provide for themselves. For most people, growing up is a natural process. As addicts, however, we seem to falter along the way. We never seem to outgrow the self-centeredness of the child. We never seem to find the self-sufficiency that others do. We continue to depend on the world around us and refuse to accept that we will not be given everything. We become self-obsessed. Our wants and needs become demands. We reach a point where contentment and fulfillment are impossible. People, places, and things cannot possibly fill the emptiness inside us, and we react to them with resentment, anger, and fear. Resentment, anger, and fear make up the triangle of self-obsession. All of our defects of character are forms of these three reactions. Self-obsession is at the heart of our insanity. Resentment is the way most of us react to our past. It is the reliving of past experiences again and again in our minds. Anger is the way most of us deal with the present. It is our reaction to and the denial of reality. Fear is what we feel when we think about the future. It is our response to the unknown, a fantasy in reverse. All three of these things are expressions of our self-obsession. They are the way that we react when people, places, and things, past, present, and future, do not live up to our demands. In Narcotics Anonymous, we are given a new way of life and a new set of tools. These are the 12 steps, and we work them to the best of our ability. If we stay clean and can learn to practice these principles in all our affairs, a miracle happens. We find freedom from drugs, from our addiction, and from our self-obsession. Resentment is replaced with acceptance, anger is replaced with love, and fear is replaced with faith. We have a disease that, in the end, forces us to seek help. We are fortunate that we are given only one choice, one last chance. We must break the triangle of self-obsession. We must grow up or die.
So what we've chosen to do this afternoon is to break the discussion into the three rather obvious topics, which is fear, resentment, and anger. And we have a wonderful speaker, formerly from Edmonton, that lives in Calgary now, that's going to speak on fear to start. And that's Shane P. from Calgary.
Thank you. I can't see Patty. Oh.
Hey, everyone. My name's Shane. I'm an addict. Yeah, I guess when thinking about standing up here and sharing, you know, and kind of finding a format for this workshop, I just thought, you know, all I have is my story, and that's all we have here. And so I'm happy to share it today. My topic is fear, and, you know, I really, just sitting here listening to the reading, we must grow up or die. I remember when that was a common message in our fellowship, you know, get clean or die, motherfucker, yeah. Right? That's kind of how I came up. And it's harsh, but it's true. You know, one of my favorite speakers, I listen to a lot of different speaker tapes, and one of my favorite speakers is a guy named Mark L. from the States, and he has a sentiment that says, most of the day I'm a five-year-old. I want, I need, I'm afraid, I want to get better, I need direction, and I'm afraid that I won't do either one of those well or get what I want when I get it. And, you know, that pretty much encapsulates my experience with recovery and, you know, on the topic of fear, especially. For me, you know, I'm one of those guys where, like many of us, you know, I had a really horrible childhood, you know, and growing up in an atmosphere of violence, you know, I was sexually interfered with as a kid, and, you know, that kind of opened up a reality for me where my foundation of how it was to go about my way in the world was immediately started through a foundation of fear. And for me, it kind of metabolized and turned into a issue of self-worth. And that has been a reality for me all across my lifespan. And even getting into recovery, you know, you think, well, okay, get into recovery and you put down the dope and, you know, we join this fellowship and we go to meetings and we do the do. And what my experience has been, fast forwarding through to today, is that, you know, none of those things really leave us, you know. What we do is we equip ourselves with the tools, with sponsors, with, you know, the meetings, the readings, the work. And our Living Clean says that we find a way to adapt and live with these realities. And we pick up better processes, better tools to navigate these realities. And that's kind of my story. I was a kid and coming up and in West Edmonton. And, you know, I was just one of those little snot-nosed kids. And I remember my first drug that I ever, I share about this sometimes, but the first drug that I ever did was really sugar, you know. And I remember being a young kid and being exposed to that movie Scarface. And I thought, oh, fuck, yeah. You know, it just instantly spoke to me. I don't know. It's something inside me that's broken that I'm really attracted to that element. And so I'd set up these giant rails of iced tea. I'd fucking start these rails of iced tea thinking I'm a badass. And that was me as a kid, like literally, you know, right in it, right from the jump. And you know, it was always undergirded by a really deeply seated fear. You know, so much of what I did and where I went and who I was based on you, based on other people, based on the people in my sphere accepting me, because I had such a deeply seated fear of, at the end, you know, in the end, I've learned is failure. I didn't want to fail. And I didn't want to be rejected. And what that meant to me is that because I had those self-worth issues, it really felt as though if I was to fail, I was worthless. And, you know, as many of us do. And, you know, the reality of my story is that I'm a really slow learner. And, you know, I'm celebrated 23 years clean this year. Thanks to Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm still, you know, I'm still dealing with this fear, and how it presents for me today is procrastination. I can procrastinate, and I can avoid, and so I gotta stay really vigilant on that through some step work, through step one, surrender. When I started using, it really was the solution for me. You know, it gave me, like many of us, it gave me that ability to be okay with myself in my body and be able to navigate relationships, and it became the crutch, right? It became the solution for a long time. I ended up on the streets here in Edmonton and got into some trouble, so I did what all of us do and hitchhiked to BC, where I was going to live the Alberta dream on the mean streets of Vancouver. along my path and along my journey, the violence followed, and in and out of jail. And, you know, I remember this one experience being in the downtown east side of Vancouver and living on the streets and getting beat up by a group of cops because I had a mouth on me. I was really lippy, and especially with regards to authority. Any form of authority would really trigger this attitude in me. And I remember getting beat up by a group of about four cops, and that was kind of a low for me, but I didn't stop using, of course. But it showed me that, the lifestyle, right? The lifestyle was not something that I was going to be able to, like, succeed with or thrive in. And that was the first time that I really felt as though, like, okay, you know, if I'm going to do this, this is kind of going to be my life. I moved back to Edmonton. Eventually, my warrants kind of, I dealt with some of my warrants and moved back to Edmonton, and that's when things actually got really bad. And, eventually I stumbled into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I think I saw little Donna here. I don't know if she's here, but I always share this. My first NA meeting was at the Detox Center. I think it was a Tuesday night or a Thursday night, and Donna was taking 8 years, and I just couldn't believe it, you know. I was like, there's no fucking way. And, like, not one time over the course of 8 years, you know, nothing. And I just couldn't believe it. And, you know, here was this room filled with people that were celebrating and happy. And, like, I was in detox. I was, like, literally, like, what do these people have to smile about? Like, obviously they're not going through what I'm going through. Obviously they've never been through what I've been through. And that was my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I wish I could say I stayed clean after that, but I ended up having to come in and out for about 4 years. And, you know, throughout that process, I was continuing to go to meetings. And, kind of circling back to the topic, what my point is, like, I got into recovery and I started working the steps. I got a sponsor. Nothing really changed for me, you know, like, I was doing the work and I was going to meetings and I was doing everything that we say we were going to do, and or, you know, the suggestions, and it just wasn't working for me. My life was still the same. I was still the same person inside, and it wasn't the bricks hadn't started to break. I think it took me, like I said, I'm a slow learner. I think it took me around 10 years. And eventually I ended up seeking some treatment for my early childhood experience. And I realized some things about trauma and, you know, how trauma is kind of a cycle and it comes and goes and it kind of lives in your life, and you just kind of have to be able to navigate it and figure out a way to, you know, get through the ebbs and the flows. And that really kind of opened my eyes up to a little bit of, a technique around dealing with things outside of the steps, outside of recovery, this trauma work. And I think at that point I had some awareness, and I had an awareness that regardless of, you know, what's available to me, this is going to be a lifelong journey. And once I had that awareness, it took me probably another 5 years to really get to a place where I was willing to change around it. Fear for me has been like just such a constant component of my life. I thought, like many of us, you know, I'm going to get into recovery, I'm going to get clean, I'm going to get some clean time, I'm going to get some recovery, and things are going to be amazing. And you know, I'm on the side of the coin now, where I've been through some really horrible stuff in recovery. You know, stayed clean through it, and you know, going through some challenging things, and specifically around relationships and work and kids, and you know, it's very, I guess it's empowering, but also very humbling to realize that, you know, despite my best efforts, I'm always going to have to deal with these challenges and these struggles. You know, I think these days, you know, through the step work, I think, again, really focusing on step one and surrender and applying some different techniques that I do has really helped me with that fear, and not just helping me with fear, but how it presents itself in my life, like I said, through that procrastination. And, you know, some of those things are very, very simple things that I'm never, you know, I'm not unveiling any secrets here, but it's so funny because in early recovery, you know, we talk about a gratitude list, and it's just such a simple method. But daily doing a gratitude list for me has really kept me grounded and kept me rooted in surrender. But following that, also doing an acceptance list, you know, things that I need to accept. And then following that, doing a powerlessness list, you know, being aware and daily checking in about what I'm powerless against and what I'm powerless over, and, you know, what's inside of my locus of control. And again, it's so funny because, you know, I feel as though it's just too simple. Like, that shouldn't be the way that it is, but it's like these are the tools and techniques that have really worked on some of that, you know, fear in my life. And again, you know, going back to just because I do have these tools, I'm still going to go through fear. I'm still going to live in a life that is oftentimes guarded by fear. You know, it's something that's within me and something that I have to keep a constant eye on. I guess, what else can I say? I was really, it was funny because when we decided how we were going to break up this this workshop, fear was the last thing I wanted to talk about, because by and large, I am a very fearful person. I think the first time that really came to my forefront was working a step four and working a step five with Jeff E. back there. And, you know, the step five experience for me was really life-changing. You know, I was able to sit back and really talk about my experience with step four and looking at myself on paper. And I had this experience where we were doing like this meditative process. And through that meditation, I was able to like revisit myself as my adult self to my younger self. And it was a really intense situation where I felt as though the only thing I could say to my younger self was, I'm sorry. And where that was rooted for me was, I'm sorry for feeling so worthless, you know, as a person, and like being in that place where I wasn't worthy, you know, I wasn't worthy of any of this stuff. And, you know, after years of work and years of recovery, what I've learned is that, you know, I am worthy. I think actually age too, I think after I turned 40, that really shifted for me, where I just felt like, okay, all of this other kind of insignificant ego bullshit aside, you know, I'm a pretty good dude. So, you know, and it was that experience with step five that really put me in touch with the ability to go back and stop the pain and kind of reset and grow from there. What else can I say about fear? I think, you know, as it relates to the triangle of self-obsession, our literature is really clear. You know, I think that we have the answers. The answers are in the literature. And we have the tools available to us. And what I guess my message today would be for any of those people that are here, you know, maybe have some recovery, have some clean time, you know, for me, it's always been stick and stay. You know, stick and stay and make it pay. And it's taken, you know, like I said, it took me around 15 years to really get to a place where I was able to change some of my internal workings and, like, deal with some of the self-worth issues. And, you know, I'm so glad that I didn't jump off that bridge or, you know, take that early exit or, like, you know, just go back out there. And we've lost a lot of people, and I've lost a lot of people. And so I think my message to everybody would be, you know, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle, you know. And, you know, I guess just going back to the promises that the program makes to us, you know, anybody can get this. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you've done. You can get it too. And yeah, I think that's me on fear. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Shane. The next speaker is going to speak on resentment, and that would be Charlie.
Everybody, I'm an addict. My name's Charlie. Before I get going, I just want to say I'm active in my recovery, and I want to really thank Denise and the committee for, I understand there was some people that were supposed to do this workshop, and for whatever reason they're not available, or bottom line is I got asked to be actively participating in this, and I'm grateful. Thank you very much, Denise. And with that, I want to share something. So we've known for a couple of weeks, and Shane got us in a three-way, what do you call those, a chat? Three-way chat, right? So, wow. Good job, Charlie. So anyway, we've been communicating for the last couple of weeks. And, holy, good job, Charlie. So, I look at my phone. I'm on my way over to my friends, and we're going to do some step work. And before I get out of my car, I look at my phone, and Shane's like, y'all mind if I take fear? When I go into my friends, I come out, you know, an hour later. Myler had responded, nope, all yours. Shane's like, LOL, you scared me. Right? I couldn't help but laugh when I read that, and I drive home, right? And when I got home, I look at my phone again. It's Myler, Charles, do you have a preference over the next two topics? And you know, my response was, either or, Myler, they're so interconnected. They call it a triangle. I call it a vicious circle. Thank God for honesty, right? So when I get up and I start making myself dinner, I come back and sit down and look at my phone. Myler says, I'll do anger. And I'm like, well, okay, now I got a resentment. Right? Right? And then Shane pops up and says, oh, I was afraid of that. Right? And Shane says, I hope Myler isn't upset. Right? I killed myself laughing. You know, I really take this seriously. I'm huge on the literature. I've been doing this journey of self-discovery for a long time. I have so many notebooks of journals, inventories, material that I've worked with, you know, over the years, you know, I come home from work and I'm going through these notebooks and I'm looking at, you know, what I've written and you know, some of the cycles, right? Some of the awarenesses, right? And I've heard lots of people. I'm a speaker, not two, and I've heard lots of people talking about burning their inventories. Please, if there's one thing I can say, that's a blueprint to my progress. And if I was to burn everything that I've done, what would I, you know, I don't know about you guys, but my brain cells obviously aren't all there, right? You know, I'm so grateful that I have this stuff that I can go back and read and go, yeah, I remember that, right? You know, and Another thing I'd like to share is I was at faith group one night, and there was a fellow introduced himself as passing through. He was from Toronto. So where I'm going is I don't know what I'm going to hear in a meeting that's going to matter to me. This young man, he said recovery's not about personal improvement. And that got my attention, right? I turned and I looked at him, and he said, recovery, the folks of recovery, the solution is spiritual in nature, right? And then he said it's about spiritual development, and that personal improvement is a byproduct of spiritual development. And that hit me. I swear I almost fell right out of the chair, because I spent a lot of my journey trying to fix everything out here, trying to get the right job, living in the right neighborhood, the right girlfriend or not, right? And I was always still a fucking liar and a cheat and a thief, right? And lazy, right? You know, and when this guy said that, I thought about stuff like, okay then. So then I need to build this all on honesty in the first step, right? And that's why I said thank God for honesty, because I can see my own truth, right? So my talk being about resentment, what I understand is that resentment means to repeat, to refeel, in annoyance often, right? I have a dictionary on my kitchen table. It was told to me by an old-timer once to get a dictionary, that if my problem is a lack of power, to recognize that words are very powerful, the words we hear and the words we say, right? So I went out and I bought myself this big Webster's dictionary, and it sits in the middle of my coffee table, and it's in my hand several times a week, right? And I looked at it last night, and I said, wow, this is I just looked up the thought about right here, Webster's Dictionary, obsession, a persistent and perhaps even a disturbing preoccupation with an idea or feeling, right? I, me, my, and mine. Those are my favorite things to talk about. Those are my favorite things to think about all day long, every day, right? You could be talking about you and yours, but I'm still thinking about me and mine, right? All the time, right? So I started looking at that. When I became aware of that, I'm listening to meetings, eh? The I, me, mine, mine, all the time. I, me, mine, mine. I, me, mine, mine, right? And I started thinking about that. Okay, my daily routine is I get up. I get up, walk over to my coffee pot, turn it on, go to my bathroom. Not sure if you guys can see where I'm going here, but there's some stuff. I, me, mine, mine. Now, that's not necessarily obsessive. That's my morning routine. But you get me in the car and I'm on my way to work, right? I find that for me, when I'm on the highway especially, I'm in a 1 kilometer bubble. I'm right in the middle. So a half a kilometer in front of me, the road is fucking mine. The road, the half a kilometer behind me, the road was mine, right? You know, so I'm all of a sudden getting disturbed, right? And once I start focusing on that disturbance, don't you guys know who I think I am? Get out of my way, huh? Anybody else feel like that sometimes on the road, right? You know, I mean, that guy that cuts in front of you, don't, buddy, like, get out of my way, right? You know, I'm late, right? You know, the whole world's got to revolve around me. So I spend a lot of time thinking about stuff like that. And so the last few nights especially, I've been thinking about resentment, eh? What is it that I'm still resentful of? You know, when I'm looking back through inventories, eh? And you know, many years ago, I was taught an inventory process that asks us, you know, what the resentment is, who it's with or what, and what it is, And it asks us how it's affected ourselves. Was it our ambition? Was it our self-esteem? Was it our pocketbook? Was it our personal relationships, including those that are sexual, right, romantic? And that's as far as I ever got, right? Again, mine, how it's affected me, right? And I couldn't help but notice I didn't take the next step. What did I do with it, right? So over the years, I've heard a lot of people say about, you know, looking at my part. Okay, that's interesting. Again, I'm a speaker nut, and I'm listening to speakers every night. And when I think about it, okay, so I'll tell you a story. When I was 6 years old, my mom and dad divorced. And, you know, the divorce wasn't pretty, and the court case was ugly. And then my dad moved me from Hamilton, Ontario, to Alberta when I was 9, and I was disconnected from the rest of my family. And that created problems for me, right? That created the beginning of a resentment. So those disconnections, my mom passed away when I was 9. The abandonment from that, whether it was intended or not, doesn't matter. I still felt abandoned, right? And, you know, some of that stuff I carried through into my relationships and until today, right? So the fact that my mom and dad split up when I was 6 years old certainly affected me. I didn't have a part in that. And that doesn't necessarily have a part in how I treat you today, right? That was then. This is now. How I treat people today, how I've treated people the last 10 years, that's all me, right? That's not a part. Having a part means that there's some sort of blame on the original threat or the original offense, right? I have to own my shit. This is about accountability, right? You know, looking at stuff like that, right? And owning it, right? Looking at relationships, my relationships. Is there anybody here that's also a scorekeeper? I keep score, hey? I did that for years, right? I got a scorecard on you. Oh, you did it again, hey? You know, yeah, we're still friends, but you did it again, right? You know, and then I started looking at, that person did it too. Made me feel the same way, right? So now it's not a scorecard anymore. Now it's a score sheet, you know? And I can eliminate, I can move the names around, but the feelings are the same. And when I feel certain ways, I automatically do certain things, right? And sometimes those things are ugly, right? And sometimes I don't necessarily respond in a kind and loving way, right? I was thinking about some of the stuff that was shared in the workshop this morning. I came into Narcotics Anonymous in July 1996 in a small town where there was only 3 or 4 of us sitting in a room. And you know, that was, meetings didn't really appeal to me, right? I wasn't really getting the experience of the we. And at 60 Days Clean, my friend takes me from this small town, and we go to Regina Convention. And I walk into a community center where there's, 500-600 people. And I'll be honest, I did not have a clue that there was even a recovery movement, right? And all of a sudden I'm like, this is bullshit, right? I didn't believe you, right? I didn't think it was possible. I was one of them people that thought, you know, once a drunk, always a drunk. Once a junkie, always a junkie, right? And you know, here people are talking about rebuilding their lives and you know, getting honest and all this touchy-feely shit that I thought at the time was fucking bullshit, right? So 30 years ago, in August, on a Saturday afternoon, just like we are now, I'm sitting at a table, and young man gets up to the microphone, introduces himself. He's from Toronto, just turned 17. Ran away from home when he was 12 years old. Ended up in Boys Town. I don't know if anybody you guys know Toronto, but Boys Town, he got taken in by the gay community, And he took the microphone. I really want to do this, but Dan just told me I couldn't. He took that microphone away from the stand, and he started working the crowd, looking in people's eyes. And he's talking about the terrible things that happened to him. You know, and I'm not saying, I literally looked at my friend at that time, and I'm thinking, 17 years old, fuck, I spilled more dope than this guy's ever done. What's he going to teach me? The way he worked that crowd, honesty, talking about the things that he was saying to complete strangers, hey, messed up his sexual identity for years. I can relate to that. Those things happen to me too. Fucked me up for a long time. I compensated, right? I had to have four girlfriends going at the same time, so you didn't think I was gay. Not saying that gay's any, I don't have an opinion on that. But I just didn't want you to think I was gay, right? So, you know, my point being is that at the time, I thought, I want to be able to share like that. I want to be able to share my truth on a stage, you know? And since then, I've made it a point when I speak to look people in the eye, right? I don't want to be looking over people's heads, right? And you know, getting back to the resentments here, I got carried away there. How am I doing, Myler, for time? Okay, so Myler gave us a bit of a format to follow, and we talked about it last night. There's some questions here that I'd like to answer in regards to resentments. What resentments dominated your thinking in active addiction? Hey, well, I'll tell you, I don't remember so much about active addiction, but I resented you guys when I got into recovery, right? I did. I literally did, because I literally I couldn't get it. I got a year clean. Once, twice, three times, four times, five fucking times, and I still got high, right? You know, so I remember I was sitting in this room 5 years ago at Jazz's table over there, and I'm thinking, so what is it that you guys are doing that I'm not? You know, looking around, we were in a men's workshop sitting with Jeff, right? And I'm thinking, this guy's 5 years clean. I remember when he came in. 10 years clean. 15 years clean. I remember when he came in. 20 years clean. 25 years clean. And here I am, you know, can't get 90 days together, right? You know, there's already then, whatever you guys are doing, I want to do it. Because I'm going to die, right? I said to Shane, reading that last paragraph, that's pretty deep. And I remember that too. Yeah, do the fucking steps or die. That's what they used to say to us back then. And I was like, whoa, that's pretty heavy duty. Maybe me and you should go outside, you know? You know, like, and I mean, that's the way it was, right? And you guys allowed me to be that way. You guys allowed me to be that asshole. There's a pamphlet on predatory behavior and disruptive behavior. I was that guy. I was that guy that was looking for the newcomers. I was that guy that was always arguing and fighting and standing up. And you know, I thought that was being assertive. If I stand up and take a step forward, that's being aggressive. I didn't even know that. I learned that here. Got to keep myself focused here, because, boy, I can go. Yeah, if you know me, don't let me get two breaths in, because I can go. How did my resentments affect my relationships? Well, that's pretty easy. That's an easy answer for me. I kept you way back here, right? You know, I shared this the other day at a birthday meeting. You know, the creator, the God that I don't necessarily understand, brought me to you guys and kept bringing me back to you guys. And that same God's brought some of you guys really close to me. And, you know, there was a time where I would only tell you certain parts of the truth. You know, then I heard an old-timer in another room saying something about lies of omission. Hey? And I went, whoa, that's pretty deep. So if I'm not telling you the whole truth, in fact, I'm still bullshitting. gave me something to think about. Right? Same guy used to say, Charlie, what you don't know, you don't know. And then he'd say something that really messed me up. He'd say, well, when you know that you don't know, that's when you start to know. And I'd be sitting in the corner, you know, here I am, you know, 2 months clean, and what the hell is this guy trying to say to me, right? My mind was messed, right? You know, and today I realize that. What I don't know, I don't know. So because of that fact, that truth, I also don't know what it is that I need to hear. I don't know what it is that I need to hear, and I don't know when I need to hear it, right? So if I'm sitting at home on the couch with the remote going like this, when there's a meeting on, I might be missing out on that thing that might be saving my life. And I don't know also that I might be sharing that thing that may save somebody else's life, right? You know, I heard it said last night about just get to a meeting, right? Just get to a meeting. You know, the hockey game will be on after, or you can watch it on YouTube, right? How did resentments justify my using, and what was the cost of holding on to them? In the end, I was all alone. In the end, I didn't trust anybody. Everybody was the problem, not me. You were all liars. You were all scammers. You know, can't get up and go to the bathroom, you know, leave the phone on the table because, you know, addicts, they'll tell you they didn't take it, and then they'll help you look for it. You know that story, right? We'll steer your shit and help you look for it. Yeah, that's where I was at. And holding on to that shit for years, it literally put me in a place where, stoned out of my mind, there's a stairwell beside the downtown inner. It goes down into the river valley. At noon, many times, I'd be sitting there with my glass toy, getting high, crying my eyes out, because I can't go in that meeting over there. I know I need to be in there. I know I belong with you guys. I know you can help me, but I can't stop. And I'm not going to be the guy that walks in the meeting flailing, going through his bag. You know, I heard somebody say, yeah, people coming to meetings, high, awesome. Yeah, I couldn't do that. So today, yeah, if you're coming to meetings, high, well, at least you're coming, right? I couldn't, right? And I literally thought I was going to die. I can't get this. I told Myler this earlier. That convention in the corner there, 2002. I remember that. Fuck. Since then, how many times? How many times did I not do what you said? And I found other things to do instead. Right? And the next thing you know, I was sitting in a chair, you know, wondering why this is happening to me again. Right? You know, it's amazing what happens in these rooms. I'm blown away, you know, emotionally. Somebody asked me to go for lunch today, and I'm like, I'm all butterflies. And it's not necessarily butterflies of fear. It's more like excitement, right? Because I remember that kid 30 years ago telling his story, right? Sharing his truth, right? And I realized how many times, you know, I held on to the lies. And was afraid, right? This triangle, I don't know about you guys, they call it a triangle. Well, let's add in the words entitlement and expectation. Now it's a fucking trapezoid, right? Now you guys pick any three other things, it becomes an octagon, right? And I go around, through, back and forth, you know, and I got lots of written work where I can see that I'm still doing it, right? It may not be as extreme. You know, the 10th step allows me to quickly look at something and realize, well, you know what? I'm being really unreasonable. And then I just raise my voice at somebody again, and I was being an asshole, and I get to walk up to him and say, can I talk to you for a minute? And go and straighten that out right away and own my shit, right? And I'm grateful for stuff like that, because that wasn't me before. I was keeping a scorecard, right? And it was always your fault, right? Another question here, and I'll end with this. How did steps 4, 5, 8, and 9 help you address these resentments? First of all, getting honest and looking what I was doing. There's a friend that's not here today. I'm kind of disappointed, but when I was doing my 85 questions in step 4, I almost puked this time around, right? Looking at what I'd done, right? Talk about assets. I couldn't even, I looked at that part and I'm like, after writing what I had just written, it was like, assets? I need to go eat, right? I'm going to puke. I didn't feel like I had any assets, right? The immense process, incredible. Not realizing that I was holding on to shit for so long. And, I need to go and look somebody in the eye and sit down with them and tell them, you know what, well, this is what happened. And apologizing isn't what it's all about. It's making it right, right? And what do you need from me now to make this right? Maybe I owe you some money, right? Maybe I owe you some of my time. And what does acceptance mean to me today? It means the starting point for everything, okay? I was told a long time ago that, it doesn't matter what happens, what the situation or the circumstances is, until I come to a place of acceptance, I won't be in any state of peace. I won't have any peace, right? And only at that point can I work forward. So with that, I'm grateful to be with you guys today. I'm glad I made you guys laugh at the beginning. A three-way, eh? Fuck. Wow. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Charlie. Are we doing okay, Mom? Sorry. I just have to. I'm seeking approval from Denise today. But again, yes. I'm going to be speaking on the anger part of the triangle, and I've done a number of speaking engagements over time, and I've always, as a matter of fact, I was always resentful and thought, if you ever read notes, that you're doing it wrong for some reason, because, well, obviously I knew better than you, but I actually started examining kind of in depth the pamphlet, and my experience with sharing is that I always come up with a topic, and not only do I not remember what I say, but I always say stuff that I kind of thought was unrelated to what I wanted to convey. And because I definitely have some sort of ADHD, I know where I got it from. My son, the comedian who was here last night, I think I shared a cereal with him when he was a kid called Fruit Loops, and I think I contacted it right then and there, but that's nor here nor there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, I wrote down a whole bunch of stuff, and then I threw it away, and then I wrote it again, and then I revised it, and then I came up with this that has meaning to me, and I just want to read it. For what it's worth to you, and it's all about the anger part of the pamphlet. So when I first came into recovery, I thought anger was simply something that happened to me. I thought certain people made me angry. Certain situations made me angry. Traffic made me angry. Family made me angry. Coworkers made me angry. The word just seemed full of things that deserved my anger. What I eventually discovered that was that anger was often less about what was happening around me and more about what was happening inside of me. The pamphlet suggests that anger comes from self-obsession. At first, the idea bothered me. It sounded like the pamphlet was blaming me for being angry. But over time, I began to understand that self-obsession doesn't necessarily mean selfishness in the way I usually think of it. It means that my thoughts were centered on me and what I want, what I think should happen, how I think people should behave, what I believe I deserve. And when reality didn't match those expectations, those desires that I had, I often became angry. One of the most useful questions I've learned in recovery is, what expectation am I holding on to right now? And many times my anger is connected to an expectation that I didn't even realize I had. Neither was, deep down inside. And I put some bullet points after this in terms of perhaps what those points are that I sometimes realized after the fact. And one of them that always bothered me as a child, I think, and never really felt like it was happening, is that I expected someone to understand me. And many times what I find is that an old wound hasn't really fully healed. And the pamphlet pointed me in a spiritual direction. And I got to tell you, me and Charlie weren't supposed to be speaking today, but we are because some people couldn't make it. And Denise called me and she asked me if you'd do this workshop. And I had no on my lips before I heard her out. And she said, it's on the pamphlet, The Triangle of Self-Obsession. And I immediately smiled. You couldn't see it because we're on the phone, but I just started laughing because it's always, always been my favorite pamphlet. Like, it's the most profound pamphlet to me. So how could I say no, right? So so the pamphlet pointed me towards a spiritual solution. So just as resentment can be transformed through acceptance, anger can be transformed through love. And it's interesting because I've talked and I've thought about love because I feel it in these rooms and I feel it from the people that are in these rooms that I associate with. And, you know, I got to say that I'm really glad you didn't really talk a lot about love when we all get here, right? Because it's so foreign, I think, fundamentally. And anyways, when I first heard that, it sounded impossible. If someone hurts me, how am I supposed to respond with love? Recovery has helped me understand that love is not a weakness. Love does, this kind of always choked me up when I was writing it. Love does not mean becoming a doormat. Love does not mean pretending everything is okay. Love does not mean abandoning healthy boundaries. Love means responding with understanding rather than reaching out from emotional impulse. Love means recognizing that other people are struggling too. Love means remembering that everyone has fears, insecurities, and pain. The one thing that it shown me that is that people who frustrate me the most are most often fighting battles I know nothing about. That's profound to me because quite often confusion for me led to anger. And part of it was because I can't fix you, you know, because I can't fix me at times. And that's confusing. And that does not excuse harmful behavior, but it helps me see people as human beings rather than obstacles standing in the way of what I want. Another thing I've learned is that anger narrows my perspective. And I've always thought that I've, for the most part, thrived and tried to be as open-mindedness as I can be. And it was interesting. I was in a seminar on Monday for work, and there was a screen, and there was a number of us like you in the audience, and the gentleman facilitating said, I want you to watch the screen, and on the screen there was people with white shirts and people with black shirts, and they were throwing a basketball to one another. And they said, it's going to take place for a couple minutes, and at the end of this, I want you to tell me how many times the people in the white shirts passed the basketball. So I watched intently the people pass the basketballs, and the people in the black shirts were passing the basketball. And at the end of it, it was rather short. I figured, well, that was easy. It was 16. And the number comes up on 16, and I'm like, yeah, I nailed it. And then the facilitator said, did you see on stage the gorilla walking into the room, standing amongst those people, and doing this and walking out? And I thought, what the hell is he talking about? Gorilla? I was watching the ball. And I thought, no, I didn't. He said, watch it again. This time don't count. So I watched it again, and sure enough, halfway through, this guy in a gorilla suit comes on and does this and walks off. And for me, it was rather profound, because I know it was a work and business related thing, but the reality is that I just went into this deep, profound thought of perspective. Where's my perspective coming from right now? Who's controlling my perspective? And it was really kind of profound, because I've been thinking about it all week long. And it applies completely to my spiritual well-being. So, love means recognizing that other people... I read that already. Another thing I've learned is that when I'm angry, everything becomes largely about my side of the story. I become the judge, the jury, and the prosecutor. Recovery encourages me to become curious instead. And curiosity, and meaning curious about where it came from, why I'm holding on to it, and why it means so much to me. Instead of asking, how could they do that to me? I can ask, what might be going on with them? Instead of asking, why is this happening specifically to me? I can ask, what can I learn from this? The shift doesn't always happen immediately. Sometimes I still get angry. Sometimes I still react. The difference today is I have tools, and I can pause before speaking. One thing that Shane mentioned, it was kind of profound. I thought about it, and it had to do with, you know, perhaps getting older. As soon as Shane mentioned that, I thought, character defects take a lot of energy to exercise. And at times, especially perhaps when we get older, they become rather exhausting. And I think it helps in us in recognizing these aspects. I can pause before speaking. I can call another member. I can pray. I can write. I can take an inventory. I can ask myself whether my reaction is helping or hurting the situation. One of the greatest gifts in recovery is learning that I don't have to obey every emotion that I feel. I can feel angry without becoming angry. I can experience frustration without acting destructively. I can disagree with someone without attacking them. That was new for me. I just figured, you should be attacked because you're wrong. Fucked up. That wasn't possible before recovery. And the pamphlet describes anger as part of the triangle of self-obsession, because anger keeps the focus on me, my needs, my opinions, my expectations, and my disappointments. Love broadens that focus. Love helps me consider others. Love helps me listen. Love helps me forgive. Love helps me to stay connected instead of isolated. And that connection is one of the greatest antidotes to self-obsession. When I'm focused on helping another addict, being of service, or listening to someone else's experience, my anger often loses its grip. I become less concerned with defending myself and more concerned with contributing. Today, anger still shows up in my life. I'm human. The difference is that anger no longer has to run it. Recovery has taught me that anger is often a signal rather than a command. and that it's time, it's a signal to examine my expectations. It's a signal to look beneath the surface. It's a signal to seek understanding. And it's a signal to apply spiritual principles, which in the time of anger, to me, is a really hard thing to do. As the pamphlet teaches, the answer isn't to suppress anger or to pretend that I'm not angry or it doesn't exist. The answer for me was to transform it and to move from anger towards love. To move from reaction toward response. To move from self-obsession toward connection. And to be mindful and to be creative with that process and not to be too hard on myself. I've always been my worst advocate in terms of who I am, who I think I am, and a lot of anger, a lot of fear, and a lot of shame, it can persist even today in those moments that I don't feel connected. And one of the catches that I caught in a meeting a long time ago was the fact that the topic was anger in the meeting, and I was listening to people share, and one of the most profound things happened through coming through that meeting was that the fact that in terms of talking about perception, I've always relatively been angry, and the motivation and the impetus and the persistence of that is because one of the major factors that allowed it to participate and continue was the fact that I agreed with it. And I've always told myself I was angry. I've never given myself a chance at times not to be angry. I always thought, I'm angry, I'm angry, I'm angry. So when I decided to say, I'm not going to be angry, I choose not to be angry, somewhat I didn't understand that it was actually a decision I could make. I thought that decision was being made for me for some reason. I really did. But now I kind of boil it all down to relatively two simple sentences that I remind myself in times of emotional, spiritual chaos is this something that I have any type of control over? Or like Onan said, like I always tell my kids when they're going on about something, I always tell them, well, it's neither good nor bad. It's actually just the way it is. And yeah, because I say it to him all the time. He stole that line from me. But really, because I ask myself that question, anything being good or bad in my life is, again, relative to perception. But I was just, before I wrap it up, because that's, I think, really all I wanted to say today, is, the longer I stay alive and perhaps stay clean, the more ironic things are. And if you had told me a decade or more ago that one of these days I would see Gary B. working on a convention committee with Denise, I would have bet you thousands of dollars that would never, ever, and even if it did happen, it wouldn't work. And I got to say, you guys are killing it, man. And I got to say thank you. Thanks.